space.
Sorry about that, everybody. Happy Tuesday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Help for HD, the HD View, Ask Dr. Goodman show. We've got gremlins already in the screening room here on the show. This is your host, Melissa Biliardi. Our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 or 877-497-4103. If you have any questions or comments, please call in. Press 1. We'll cue you into the show. Please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. And thank you, 74,100 listeners, for tuning in. Tonight we get to have Ask Dr. Goodman show. We've missed you, Dr. Goodman. Welcome back.
Thank you. You've had some good shows while I've been gone. Yeah.
Yes, we have. But we have definitely missed you and your practical help for us. So we're going to talk about your latest article, Body Discomfort and Pain in Huntington's Disease. And this particular article and information is very near and dear to my heart because, as you know, my Jimbo is suffering with a lot of pain. So tell us about these two recent studies that you heard about, that you found out about in the UK.
Well, they're really studies on quality of life measures. There are the researchers, make scales of or ways to measure quality of life in chronic disease and of all sorts. And then they survey individuals with a disease to see what sorts of things is interfering with life and quality of life, more than others. And certainly it wasn't a study on pain. It was a study on quality of life, both of them. One of them was done just with Huntington's patients, and that was the Aaron one. And the other study was done in about five or six neurodegenerative diseases, and Parkinson's wasn't one of those in that second study. But there were more than 50 patients, Huntington's patients, in that study, and about the same kind of questions were asked on the quality of life survey. And one of the questions was, do you have bodily pain or discomfort, and how severe is it on a scale of 1 to 5, where I think it's, 0, you don't have any, and then there's a little, and then there's a moderate amount, and then there's a lot, and then it's more than you can stand.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes, you check how much of this symptom you're having. And it was just one of many different things that questions that were asked. So it came as a little bit of a surprise, I think. It came as a surprise to me, I don't know how to many other people, that it was reported so highly in people who were at middle stages of disease. So people who were essentially not working anymore, but still had, many had still had a lot of independence. Mm-hmm. It varied from early middle disease to later middle disease, but not advanced disease, not confined to a wheelchair or a nursing home or something like that. These were not the type of people that were in the survey. So it was a higher number than expected. So I did a little research on it and could find, very little in Huntington's, and then tried to learn a little bit more about it in other diseases where it's been studied that might apply, have some application to Huntington's. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, reported more than 50% suffered from at least moderate discomfort pain and about 10% more severely. So that's a large number, considering most people don't really relate pain to Huntington's, but I do know a lot of people that have pain, including my son,
Right? No. I think it's one of the things I point out is we don't ask. It hasn't been studied in Huntington's. Nobody knew it was this being reported this high, would have been reported this highly, because it really hadn't been asked before, or at least if it has been, I did not find it in other studies. And these were new and caught my eye. It's possible that there were other studies in the past that I ignored too. But it is something that virtually no time has been spent on for Huntington's, and there are reasons for that. You know, pain isn't visible. You don't go in. You can see chorea, and you can see someone who's, and you can experience someone who's irritable or depressed, but you don't see pain, and so people need to complain about pain or be asked about pain. Researchers haven't had this, in their UHDRS where they, you know, there are many, many different questions, but there's nothing about pain or discomfort. So it's
something
not
that
something
should be
that,
added in there, maybe.
Well, it certainly is a part. It clearly is a part of Huntington's. 50% of people are complaining about it affecting their quality of life, at least moderately. And we don't know very much about it because it hasn't been studied. And I'm going to guess that many patients with Huntington's don't complain about pain. I don't believe my patients do, but I can't say that I ask about it every time. I can say that I don't ask about it every time. I hope I will be better about it in the future.
might be a good thing to... It's almost like once you do ask, then that kind of opens up a whole nother, you know, practicing pain management, right? I mean, that's a
right.
whole other field.
Right. Pain certainly contributes mm-hmm. to other problems, depression, anxiety, irritability. Mm-hmm. You know, the list goes on. Pain is not something that any of us we would prefer not to deal with.
Do we know where that pain is coming from? Is it neurological pain or?
Well, in Parkinson's, they looked at this.
Mm-hmm.
They broke it down. You know, pain is, if you take pain complaints or discomfort complaints from the general population, you know, it's hard to put them into categories. It's hard, you know, to describe pain often. You know, it's not so hard if you've broken your leg and it hurts there. That you can describe, and everybody gets it. Other kinds of pain, like headache, is harder to describe. You know, and in neurodegenerative disease, at least in Parkinson's and certainly in my more advanced patients that I see in nursing homes, those people are having pain that they can't describe or give a name pain to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually manifest by various kinds of agitation. Now, of course, Huntington's people can complain of pain too. So I'm not saying all
right,
patients
right.
don't. But I think sometimes people are having discomfort and find it hard to describe. And there are reasons, the probable reason for that is that brain cells are damaged that help, you know, process a pain signal. You have a pain impulse coming from somewhere in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets transmitted, that impulse, to brain, but then that needs to be interpreted cognitively. And if cells and pathways are damaged, then you have the sensation of discomfort, but you don't know what it is.
Okay.
So you can't put words to it.
Mm-hmm. So you can't describe
so that's
it.
Why
it articulate
that's
it.
Why it. There's discomfort, so there's screaming or pacing or restlessness. Sometimes aggression can be a sign of some kind of discomfort or pain.
So then how do we treat that with really not exactly knowing if it's pain or not. For example, in the later stage when they're not verbalizing as much. How do you address
what
that?
What should be done is when a person is agitated, you try to find a reason for it. Maybe there is a urinary tract infection. Maybe there is some other injury. Maybe there has been osteoporosis in people who are bedridden more so, and a fracture that wasn't fall related. So you need to look and certainly see if there is a source of the pain that's visual, or that you can find by checking, you know, a number of usual tests. And then if you can't find an etiology, if you can't find something to hang your hat on, then at least in these later studies that I mentioned, inpatients, nursing home patients who were agitated, they treated half of them and they didn't find a source of what might be causing pain. They treated half of them with narcotics and half of them not. The group that was treated, many more of those, the agitation did not recur. I mean, went away and didn't recur. And there was those people who were not treated with pain medication, then there was more prevalent, there was more agitation in those individuals. So one surmises that there was some kind of discomfort that they couldn't verbalize, that we couldn't find, that was causing the same thing as pain, that they couldn't interpret it as pain.
So what types of pain might an HD person experience?
It's generally broken down into musculoskeletal pain. So if you've had an injury, and that can be, you know, an acute injury and a broken bone or a sprained ankle. It can be a chronic injury from back, chronic use trauma. In people who have chorea, they are being literally jerked around, and the muscles are being jerked around. And a prominent, at least for me, a prominent complaint for people particularly who have had having more chorea is that their back hurts.
Mm.
And
all those
it makes sense
are getting
that
jerked
is
around.
Right.
Oh.
So there's that's a component, and I've certainly had people complain of back pain.
Mm-hmm.
One person in a nursing home said his back was broken. Well, it wasn't broken, but he couldn't say it hurt, but he said it was broken.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different ways of expressing it, and then that became, for that gentleman, a chronic source of discomfort for him. So that's one part of it. You know, we all have aches and pains, and people with Huntington's have aches and pains too, only more of them because they have these movements that are happening, whether it's, and muscle tightness with rigidity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a combination of the fast movements like chorea and dystonic movements, and then there's also the stiffer muscles that come along with Huntington's. You know, people with Huntington's are more sedentary are kind of forced to be in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And when any of us are sedentary, we have more aches and pains. If you get out there and do some reasonable exercise, you will have fewer aches and pains than just lying around. Now, when I say just lying around, well, people with Huntington's cannot get up and go. Often. So I think there's a component of that as well, being out of shape. So when you do move, it hurts more.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is some evidence that pain is misinterpreted. I've had a patient who broke her clavicle. I think I mentioned this in the article.
Ouch.
And, of course, she had to be having pain. So you ask her if she has pain, and she says, yes and points to her toe.
Yeah.
So she knows she's having, you know, there's something wrong.
Oh.
But she cannot localize it.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to tell me that there's pain, but she can't actually, her brain cannot localize that it's actually mm-hmm. the clavicle that hurts. Now, maybe her toe was hurting too, but, you know, one would have thought that she would have complained of her recent fracture.
But maybe if she had fallen, maybe a good measure would be to x-ray and make sure nothing's broken, that kind of thing.
Right, and there's certain fractures that are obvious without an x-ray.
Uh-huh.
Can
wow.
be if one looks at them, looks
yeah,
at one carefully.
Yeah, because if they can't express that they have pain, how can you treat them for
right.
that?
Right, it's a little bit like a baby.
Yeah, it is.
You know, a baby who cries can't tell you where the pain is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Can't put it into words because they don't have the words. So it, they express it in irritability and crying and screaming, and so one has to look for a source of you know where that's coming from,
mm-hmm.
and it's harder in the aged. It's hard. I'm not a pediatrician. I'm sure it's hard in babies too. It certainly was with mine growing up when you didn't know what was wrong with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's that similar sort of thing when many more things can go wrong in the. More things break as we get older, and certainly with Huntington's or other chronic diseases.
I've noticed too that there's some peripheral pain or pain on the skin. Is that what you call peripheral
right.
pain?
Right, that's called something called. I didn't talk about that. It's something called hyperalgesia. Mm-hmm. Which means that you are more responsive to any noxious stimulus,
mm-hmm.
cold, hot, you know, an electrical stimulus
mm-hmm.
or other pain inflicted on people. This is the most common. This hasn't been shown to happen in Huntington's.
Mm-hmm.
But it hasn't been studied. There has been one study. That would suggest one study that I didn't understand because I don't understand the how they measure pain. They're different studies use different ways of measuring pain. They
mm-hmm.
they put people's hands in cold water and ask you when you different temperatures and ask you when it starts to feel uncomfortable, and then they keep you in that cold water until you can't stand it anymore. So
nice.
It's both the threshold of discomfort and the intolerability of it.
Right.
So when you take your hand out. So there's more than one kind of measure. It turns out that there's not that much difference between people with Huntington's and a control population, but there may be less tolerability, so the hand is taken
uh-huh.
out sooner. Now, this hasn't been shown in Huntington's. They didn't study that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the, fibromyalgia is a condition where many parts of the body hurt,
mm-hmm.
and there is a hyper, so in touching the skin or pressure on the skin is felt to be discomfort when it's not felt to be discomfort in a control person who doesn't have fibromyalgia. The other time that it occurs is when people have been on narcotics long term. There is a situation where there is this what's called opioid hyperalgesia,
mm-hmm.
which means that response to a noxious stimuli, whether that whatever pain stimulus the study uses, the response is much earlier in someone who's been on chronic narcotics
uh-huh.
than someone who has not. So sometimes increasing narcotics it actually creates a syndrome
uh-huh.
where there is more pain.
Right.
Because it doesn't take as much to cause a painful stimulus. And that's a very, very hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
To deal with
that relief for the pain, right?
Right, but
yep.
then you, it's given for the pain, but and increasing the dosage can be helpful briefly, but then the dosage has to be increased again, and you have this cycle of ever increasing dosage with pain recurring or even increased pain. So increasing dosage is not helpful for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
The chronic use narcotics. We didn't used to know that.
yeah.
Certainly in my generation, this didn't become known, at least that I'm aware of, until, you know, a decade, 15 years ago. And so there's more caution about this, and it happens in the treatment of migraine headaches very often, more commonly probably than other conditions, that you one needs to withdraw the medicine, and there will be an exacerbation of headaches as one tapers it down, but in the long run you have many fewer headaches in the long run, not in the short run.
Mm-hmm.
So narcotics become part of the problem if used on a chronic basis and not tapering them or not being off of them part of the time. And there's
mm-hmm.
lots of different research information trying to explain why, as far as I can tell, there's not total agreement, and different studies show different things, but that it happens is pretty clear. Mainly, the tolerance for a painful stimulus becomes something much more.
Yeah, when you try to decrease the medication, then you have twice as much pain.
Well, you taper by a small amount slowly,
mm-hmm.
and will you likely have more pain then? Yes. But the goal is to make the long-term comfortable, because if we ever increase narcotics, you know, narcotics, dose-related cognitive problems, blood pressure control, heart rate control, breathing ability, those things get impaired.
Right.
With the higher dosages more. So you're causing more side effects when you're actually not helping pain very much for very long. So very diminishing returns with risk benefit with getting real high on narcotics and with people who are on them long term. It's a very, very difficult problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, it looks like there's been some studies with pain in Parkinson's. So is that a common thing in Parkinson's?
Their numbers are about the same. When you do the same quality of life interviews, they have about the same, in the range of 50% or so. It's very similar to what these two surveys for Huntington showed, and it's similar to those other neurodegenerative diseases that the ataxias and there's some other genetic neurodegenerative diseases that had as much pain as Huntington's did. Go ahead.
Does Parkinson's have like dystonia and that kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay. And the dystonia is where the muscles kind of crunch up and it's very painful?
Yes. When you say crunch up, I'm not quite sure what you mean. The
kind of
dystonic
draw.
Movements tend to be ones of not, they're involuntary muscle contractions that are higher amplitude usually than the chorea.
Mm-hmm.
And they happen in Huntington's too, particularly in the later stages of disease, the same kind or similar kind of dystonic movement. Now, that's different than rigidity.
Mm-hmm.
One's a movement and the other is a rigidity.
So dystonia is the movement?
Yes, dystonic,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what about the myoclonic muscles contractions?
I'm not aware that they are painful, but, you know, I'm not the expert on this. I do have, with my juveniles, I have had myoclonic muscle activity, and at least three of those, none of those, have complained of pain. It's something that they're unaware of.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's a small sample, and I'm not the expert on it. But I don't, you know, I have to say that. And the audience needs to know that, you know, this is something that hasn't been studied in Huntington's, and there's a bit of hand-waving that we do to try to explain things, and sometimes we're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So take everything I say with a grain of salt here, because there's really not much really known about pain syndromes or how to optimally treat them in Parkinson's or certainly in Huntington's or in other neurodegenerative diseases.
Right. I guess we won't really know until we start asking.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, people should tell their doctors about.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be, you don't have to feel it like, you know, a broken bone. If there's, body discomfort means that the whole body is achy. That's bodily discomfort, you know, like when we, similar to, you know, before we get the flu, before the fever comes, we're achy, or as the fever comes, we're achy all over and we feel lousy. And then we have the fever and we know why we feel lousy. So that is actually the kind of discomfort I'm talking about, bodily discomfort defines.
Now, what do you know about fibromyalgia in Huntington's disease? Anything? I have heard of it.
Fibromyalgia is defined as it's a syndrome. You know, there's not a blood test that you do to diagnosis, but it's hypersensitivity or lesser noxious stimuli will evoke pain or discomfort in someone with fibromyalgia, and it tends to be along, you know, exterior surfaces of arms and legs. Certain areas of the head and trunk and back certainly are the more prominent areas, but it varies from person to person. And there are brain changes in people with when they're having fibromyalgia pain. So it's not, you know, it's not a voodoo diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I think we're all born with different pain thresholds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there will be some people who have high pain tolerance and other people who don't, and that has to have something to do with genetics and, you know, brain chemistry. Do I know what it is? No. The Parkinson's people did try to find the fibromyalgia connection, and one of the articles I think I listed, which of course you can't download unless you have a university hospital letting you do it.
Mm-hmm.
But they did find that to be, the complaints to be similar to that of fibromyalgia. Is it the same syndrome, or do people have fibromyalgia and Parkinson's? I don't think anyone knows. Or at least I certainly don't.
There's just so much that we don't know, and I guess we just need more studies and more research and probably more communication with our physicians and
right.
patients, you know.
Pain, a lot of time,
I know a lot of times, you know, when you're trying to describe something to a physician, in some ways they'll say, well, that's not Huntington's, or that doesn't happen in Huntington's. But the thing is, we don't really know, because it seems as though everyone is different.
Right.
And I've heard we can at least
say that it doesn't commonly happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that we shouldn't, if it doesn't commonly happen, or if it's, you know, very rare, then we need to consider that it might be that in addition to Huntington's,
mm-hmm.
and look for another source. So I think that's part of, or at least I would, that is a more positive way of looking at it from the doctor's point of view. I hope it is not that the symptom is being ignored.
I hope
that's
so,
more
too,
negative point of view.
Because then you have the agitation, the depression, and the patient that feels like they're not getting some relief, you know.
Right.
But I don't know if anybody out there in the chat room has any questions for Dr. Goodman tonight. But I'm really glad that you did this article, because it really addresses something, you know, that we haven't really talked about much, the pain and agitation.
No, there's so little out there about it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
now, what about in late stage? Now, you're talking about pain and agitation in late stage disease with dementia in your article.
Of in the last several years, I have gone to, you know, be a consultant in nursing homes with Huntington's disease patients, and of course these are people that will have more advanced disease or have had more behavioral problems perhaps than others who are at home. So or more difficult patients, I guess you could say, or patients who didn't have care partners for whatever reason are in nursing homes. This group of people, when there's also, you know, a fair amount of cognitive decline, or they can't talk, their speech is not intelligible. Agitation can happen for a number of reasons, but if you can't find the reason for it, and alleviate that reason, then one needs to consider that there is pain somewhere,
mm-hmm.
that you haven't found a source of, but that they're having pain. And the studies would suggest, and my experience with this kind of patient who's frequently agitated and can become aggressive, is to look for a source of pain, and if you can't definitely find it, treat that patient anyway for pain. And in my experience, it helps more than 50% of the time.
Good point. We do have a caller tonight who would like to ask a question. Caller, welcome to the show. I'm sorry I didn't get your name. If you'd like to state your name and your question to Dr.
Nancy.
Goodman. Hi, Nancy. Yes, welcome
Nancy.
To the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I am a person who has Huntington's disease, and I have a great deal of the type of pain that I think may be dystonia or cramping up of my muscles. And I haven't been diagnosed with any other condition other than that cramping, and it is quite painful. If I'm given treatment for it, even aspirin, my mood is better. I'm about 7 years into the disease, 7-8 years. And I was wondering, you know, if dystonia itself is actually a part of Huntington's disease, or is it a separate illness?
No, well, can you have two diseases? You can, but that would be rare. And dystonia is usually, do you mind telling me how old you are?
I'm 57.
Okay. I think
so I'm kind of a super ager in this disease.
So you're not of a juvenile onset where we might expect more dystonia. Dystonia is not, dystonic movements aren't that as common in later onset, but they can occur. And everyone is different. So sometimes it's difficult to tell between chorea and dystonia, not dystonia, but dystonic movements. It's hard for the doctor to tell sometimes. But whichever involuntary movement it is, it can be causing pain, certainly in extremities or in the back.
Yeah.
And the first treatments would be things like Tylenol. Or ibuprofen, aspirin is not used as much, as recommended as much as Tylenol just because of certain side effects. Now, you don't want to use a lot of Tylenol, or you can have side effects from that, too. But the first recommendation usually for pain that isn't severe is Tylenol or an anti-inflammatory like naproxen or ibuprofen.
Yeah, I understand that. My doctor had prescribed a medication called Tramadol, and oddly enough, it did work not only on the pain that I was having. I have a back pain too, but it worked on the pain, and it also worked on my mood. And so when you mentioned that there was agitation in people who were experiencing pain in nursing homes and so on, who were further on in the disease, I was, you know, it's sort of a bell went off in my head. I said, well, you know,
sure.
Now I have taken myself off of that medication under that doctor's recommendation, but I am just beside myself with the amount of cramping I'm having in my legs and in my back and so on. And
now,
I'm going to assume it's Sonia.
Can I ask you a question? I know you don't have to go into detail if you don't want, but I think part of the problem is that we're not kind of able to describe the pain, how it comes on. What does an episode look like, and is it constant or is it intermittent? Does it, you know, escalate?
Yeah.
I mean, can you describe an episode or how it comes on, if there are triggers for it and that kind of thing?
I woke up this morning and I had what I would have as a young person. I was very athletic, as a Charlie horse in my leg, but it was not a Charlie horse. And that one little muscle you could feel in my leg just remained tight for the remainder of the day. And I'm still limping around on it.
Mm.
And on the other side of my other foot, it's constantly cramping up and wanting to turn inward and down.
Mm.
I do not have a whole lot of chorea, but I do have these, and then I have the tightening in my back, too.
Mm-hmm.
I thought my hips, I went to a pain doctor and told the pain doctor that my hips were hurting, and he said, no, it's the Huntington's disease. It is your back is hurting from atrophy and other things. So I'm able to describe it, and it just, what brought that tensioning of the muscle in my leg was I kind of stretched a little bit as I was trying to wake up, and it completely locked up. The whole entire muscle locked up and stayed that way. It's still that way.
It sounds actually more the muscle contraction of like a Charlie horse. It sounds similar to that.
It happens frequently, though. I mean, it's not.
Yes. Yeah. No, sure.
Yeah. It feels what I would describe it to you as a Charlie horse, but it's not a Charlie horse. I mean, it's not something. I mean, I got muscle aches and stuff. I was a figure skater many years ago, but athlete, but. Now, I mean, I'm pretty sedentary. There isn't anything that would cause a Charlie horse. This happens quite frequently, and it seems to travel. Sometimes the pain is felt in my ankle. It's sometimes it's a muscle contraction like that, it's a muscle contraction in my back, and I'm able to verbalize it. But if I were to go into my doctor and say, listen, I have this pain and this pain and this pain, they would say that I was just there seeking drugs.
Yeah.
So I don't get any treatment.
Does anything...
You know, if you have been a figure skater and been, you know, quite the athlete, you may well have certain problems in your back related to that.
Yeah.
That might be putting pressure on certain nerve groups if these Charlie-like things, whatever they are, tend to occur in the same muscle groups? Or do they kind of flip over different ones?
It just, you know, from day to day, it goes from one spot to the next, to the next, to the next.
Well, my theory is not correct.
I think it might be just going on in my brain. I think my brain is actually doing it, I'm having difficulty explaining it to my doctor. I have changed doctors since. I'm going to have to go back in there and explain this. Don't know how
Do you have physical therapy? Have you tried that? Just muscle strengthening?
The previous doctor I had was just, he was completely frustrated with me, you know, felt that everything I did had an agenda, you know, a drug-seeking agenda, you know, and in all actuality, I did go to a pain doctor, you know, and he said there's nothing wrong with the way you're taking your medications and so on to treat the Huntington's disease.
Sure.
He contested it, you know, so I changed doctors.
Nancy, is there anything that relieves it, any kind of pressure point or heat or anything that relieves that Charlie horse feeling in your muscle?
Not really. I mean, I just have to let it go away, you know, over time. So
walking,
it has really
it
affected
itself.
My quality of life here.
I'm asking questions because
be that muscle relaxants will be helpful. Tizanidine is a drug that if you were, you know, you're not my patient, but it is and I haven't examined you, so I'm not giving you specific medical advice, but if you were general patient, I would consider a muscle relaxant, and this one doesn't have as many sedative side effects, and sometimes may help that kind of muscle distress.
Yeah, I should suggest then some type of muscle relaxant.
Could you name that again, Dr. Goodman, what the name of that medication is?
Tizanidine.
Hmm.
And that's the generic.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that before.
Trying to phonetically.
Well, you've probably heard of the brand name that's escaping my brain at the moment. Xanaflex.
Oh, Xanaflex.
Now, it's not anything like Valium or Ativan, which are also in sometimes considered muscle relaxants. But this one, I think, is, it's used with the kind of discomfort that you're describing when it occurs in multiple sclerosis. And is helpful in that disease. I'm not saying it will be helpful. I'm saying it's possible that it would be helpful in Huntington's disease with a similar complaint.
It would be good to open the dialogue with this doctor, you know, since he's a new doctor and he's looking at me fresh here.
It is a drug that's used in, tell him it's a drug that's used in muscle, in multiple sclerosis for the kind of muscle spasms you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how it sounds to me. You know, I'm not your doctor, but you're pretty descriptive. You actually are.
Yeah.
Many patients are much less descriptive. So I think it's reasonable for you to ask him to consider it.
I'll give it my best. You know, my quality of life has gone down. On the tramadol, because it did actually treat the pain, I was much easier to get along with, and now I have some agitation. I think it's probably being expressed, the pain is being expressed as agitation. Yeah. I mean, that's why I called
him.
Well,
I think the tizanidine would be a better choice than the tramadol.
Yeah. I'm not on the tramadol anymore.
Right.
I guess it has other side effects and so on, so I'm a little concerned.
It does,
about
and
that.
It's not treating the reason you're having the pain.
Mm-hmm.
If my theory is correct, if you help with the muscle spasm, you will help the pain. So if you treat the cause of the pain, that's much better than using a pain medication that just covers up what's going on.
So you think maybe people with MS, they have spasms and because of the progressive weakness? Or
they have muscle spasms that are painful. And that's a well-known sort of thing with multiple sclerosis. Does it happen in Huntington's? It may very well. It just hasn't been looked at.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much.
That's what it sounds like to me, but again, you go to your own doctor and describe and, you know, just say, this works in multiple sclerosis, can I try it?
It's not addictive, right? I mean, it doesn't have bad side effects or anything?
No.
Okay, very good.
It's not without side effects, and you can go Google it and look it up, but it's a drug that's more commonly used in multiple sclerosis.
I see.
But it's more recently being used in dystonia.
Interesting.
Well, that's why when you said the agitation, I became very, very interested because it almost seems like the pain is being manifested as just aggravation.
It's frustrating if you heard all the time, it's frustrating all the time. It's probably interfering with sleep.
Yes.
Mobility. So all of those things would make a person much more irritable and then irritable/agitated, sure.
Right. And I'm 57. I have a son in the household who is also gene positive. So, he's ill. So this has been difficult for me. But thank you very much.
I will now be looking at
the MS here to see, you know, about the spasm and so on.
We wish you luck.
Well, let me know if it works.
Okay. Thank you very much for your help.
Nancy, stay in contact with us. Let us know how you're doing.
Okay.
Okay.
I will.
Take care. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good information, and you've given me a thought too that I might be able to inquire about Xanaflex or tizanidine is what I guess it's called, tizanidine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now remember, it's these are not recommendations for specific people because I'm not doing that. But making you aware, making the audience aware that it is a alternative that one can try under a doctor's supervision.
Of course.
And though it hasn't been, its use hasn't been officially reported in Huntington's, there have been anecdotal reports as well as, and using the multiple sclerosis. We have to, with Huntington's, we have to use Parkinson's disease as an example. We have to use other diseases because we don't have our own example.
Well, and they're neurologic in nature, so, it's kind of logical.
It helps the doctor know that if they don't know this drug and it's being used for this problem in multiple sclerosis successfully, then the doctor will, they're not born with this knowledge. And particularly if you're a generalist, you don't know about it. So not to go in demanding it, but instead to
inquiry.
So you heard about this, and it seems to be useful in multiple sclerosis. Could I try it?
And apparently fibromyalgia as well. So I just looked it up real quick. I've had, you know, people in my support group that have complained about pain, quite a bit of pain. I did have one gentleman whose wife was diagnosed with, of course she had Huntington's, but they diagnosed her with fibromyalgia, and that's, you know, that's a hard one, isn't it, to diagnose?
To be sure of. I mean, unless you're, because the scans that are done in research are not done cannot be done in clinical practice. So it's a diagnosis of that you have to make clinically your best educated guess.
Right.
It is very difficult.
One of our chat room person, Mary, says, and check the potassium.
Yeah, for cramping, for sure.
Yeah. And then,
I mean, there can be other reasons. Certain drugs will make the potassium go down. You know, medical. When I talk about these things, if she came to my office, would I check a potassium? Yes, I would.
Mm-hmm.
So there are always other medical things that may need to be checked, particularly if she's hypertensive and on a drug that makes her lose potassium, for instance. Then that would be the more likely diagnosis. So depending on what other factors are and what other drugs they're on, you know, all of these things make a difference, and that's where the doctor should be making some, helping you make those. But checking potassium is a great idea. Yes, magnesium too.
Magnesium. Mm-hmm. What about vitamin
right.
D?
Vitamin D needs to be kept at a normal level and has been associated with a lot of different things if it's low, like, you know, depression and a number of things. So vitamin D level, I think, is wise checking, particularly in women, and, you know, not every year, but to find out if it's low, particularly as we get older and in a woman in her 50s as she was, then a vitamin D level, there are a number of medical reasons for checking that and correcting it. Will it help her pain? I think that's relatively low likelihood, but could it might? Yeah, but you need to correct it for other reasons too.
Mm-hmm. Another one of our chat room people said he just started muscle relaxers for back pain. So I think that's kind of something that might help with the muscles for sure, huh?
Well, you know, it depends on what muscle relaxants, certain classes of them can be addictive too. The benzodiazepams like Valium, like Ativan, lorazepam, and they have other kinds of side effects when you withdraw as well. So it depends on what muscle relaxant that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Interesting. I'd like to see some studies being done more in the U.S. relating to pain in Huntington's.
Right. They're hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
I might add, pain studies in the general population are hard to do because, you know, it's hard to make a diagnosis of, you know, one pain syndrome and not having overlapping ones. So it turns out to be actually a very hard research thing to study. But just finding out more about, you know, if people are hurting, have physical discomfort in Huntington's is the way to begin. And having it described and trying to put it into different categories. One of the points that the Parkinson study made was that for the same complaint of pain, Parkinson's people were not treated for pain as often as their controls. Isn't that amazing?
That's odd.
Well, it's perhaps there's fear of prescribing things in people who have Huntington's or Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm.
But it is under treated when you compare it to the same complaint for someone who didn't have Parkinson's disease.
Interesting. So because of the diagnosis of Parkinson's or Huntington's, maybe they're just not addressing it?
It may well be. You know, nobody, you know, why that, you know, it was just noted that it was and that that wasn't right and that pain should be addressed in people with Parkinson's too. They didn't find out why doctors were prescribing or were trying to help people deal with pain less in Parkinson's than in other, and then in a control population.
Boy,
maybe they thought. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I certainly appreciate, I know my Jimbo's happy. Finally, you're talking about pain. That's the number one complaint. So I appreciate the fact that you've addressed this issue, and I'm hoping that when people are listening to this show, whether they're archive or live listeners, that give it some thought and, you know, discuss it with your physician and your patient. If you're a caregiver or, you know, if you are the one that has Huntington's, like our caller, you know, it's a hard thing to talk about when you're dealing with other problems because they don't seem to want to listen. And I noted, right, you know, some frustration in our caller's voice about, you know, doctors are thinking, you know, that you're drug seeking, which, how do you overcome that, you know?
You know, there are other modalities for treating pain, so you don't go into the office and say, I need a narcotic, you know, because the red flags will go off. You know, you have to also remember that there are drug seekers out there who come into doctors' offices.
Mm-hmm.
And so doctors are sensitized. The federal government is much more tight on prescribing, on physicians' prescribing. So it is a sore point in physicians' offices. I've had people who clearly, who were drug seeking.
Mm-hmm.
I have had people who have used their loved one's drug from terminal cancer. So you have people out there who abuse it, and doctors have had experience. The rare doctor who wouldn't have had experience with this and been burned by it. I was burned once when I had a patient who came in complaining of pain who was in a methadone clinic. But he didn't tell me he was in a methadone clinic. I found out circuitously, so clearly this person had taken advantage of me, my kindness, which I thought was kindness, or what I thought I was taking good care of this person, when really I was being manipulated into prescribing him narcotics. So doctors need to have their red flags out there. They're not just being nasty on purpose.
Right.
But one takes special precautions with these drugs because, for any number of reasons, there have been deaths from too many deaths from overuse and abuse of these drugs, and by people using them incorrectly. You know, there's been an increase in that over the last couple of years, which has made it appropriate that the FDA and institutions would be more sensitive, would be more careful about prescribing. But one can certainly go overboard and say, well, I'm not going to prescribe any. I'm not going to have any problems with this, so I'm not going to prescribe any. And that's
right.
An error, too.
So
the pendulum has swung maybe a little too far in that direction.
Well, it's the 4% of the abusers that make it difficult for the 96% of those who are legitimately needing and utilizing, you know, pain medications for their condition. So it's really...
Well, I don't know where you got those numbers, but they sound a little bit too positive to me. But I don't know the numbers.
I've actually got them from our pharmacist because, I don't know, you probably didn't hear, we got into a situation where our pharmacist was completely cut off from his shipments of his controlled medications. And he's a pain management pharmacy, so naturally he's going to have a higher ratio of the controlled substance medicines being, you know, dispensed from his pharmacy.
Sure.
And so basically what that did is it put my son in a very deadly situation where he's, you know, been on the controlled medications for so long, you can't just cold turkey cut somebody off like that. They'll go into shock and die.
Of course.
And, you know, unfortunately, he had to go to hospice for a month until he could, you know, then get the medications that he needed. And, you know, this is a really tragic thing for him, because it just threw him into, you know, a kind of a spiral where...
And you, those are terrible things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry that happened.
And so now we're in a situation where his care provider is not wanting to provide care now to him because of this. And it's not his fault. He didn't do this, you know. He was released on these high levels of medication from a hospital, and, you know, we've had to manage it and titrate slowly to get him down. And so now, you know, we're in a situation where, guess what? If he doesn't have primary care, he's probably going to have even more trouble and end up in the hospital again and again and again. So, you know, it's a conundrum for sure, because we need the controlled medications for the people who need them and who are using them properly. You know, punish the people who are misusing and abusing the medications. Don't punish the ones who are actually needing them and using them properly, you know.
Well said. Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm going to get off my soapbox now. And again, Dr. Goodman, I just want to thank you for bringing this up. It's really an important thing that we all need to be talking about, and sharing this information with our doctors, with our caregivers, and with our family members, so that we can help our loved ones who are suffering. And I think we'll conclude the show unless, let's see, let me check the chat room real quick. We have, let's see, and they do, if I, okay, Mary says, amen. Okay, thanks, Mary. So we'll conclude the show tonight. And Dr. Goodman, I appreciate you coming back on. We've missed you. And thank you for spending this time with us. And we thank everyone out there for tuning in. And please contact me at helphd-international.org. Find us on Facebook, helphd-international.org. And come back and listen to the on-demand episodes. We now have 145 shows. And Dr. Goodman has many of those, so please look her up in Blog Talk Radio and iTunes. Also available on the app is the original mobile connection to education, resources, and information about JHD and HD. So everyone out there, have a good night, and we will talk to you next week. Dr. Goodman, stay with me for a moment. Good night, everyone. I lost Dr. Simmons on the month, so y'all have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great week.